I'm not a fag. A
fag is a sissy.
A fag can't even throw a ball.
Name one fag who's a hero.
Name one fag who's got a call from the president saying, great game.
Name one fag that's fucked every Dallas cheerleader. Name one fag every kid wants to grow up to be.
So why would anyone think I was a fag?
Maybe because you had your dick up my ass?
From Slightly Unbalanced, we are still queer as folk. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Today we're talking about episode 10 of season 4, and it's called The Snake in Paradise.
It first aired in the U.S. on June 20th, 2004. It was written by Michael McLennan, his 11th of 14 episodes. We tend to like his episodes, and he also produced 61 episodes of Queer as Folk.
The Snake in Paradise was directed by John Fawcett. This is his second of three episodes. His last was The Dangers of Sex and Drugs from season 2. That was the episode where Justin became a Babylon go-go boy dancing on the bar in really awful Levi's briefs. And
yes,
George,
and was almost drugged.
That's right. And George Schickel asked Emmett to go on a world tour with him. Those were the heady days of really great Queer as Folk episodes.
R.I.P. George. So here's the synopsis of The Snake in Paradise. Drew Boyd proves to be quite the top with Emmett in a string of seedy motel hookups, and no amount of Justin's fucking chicken soup and or his Twinkie butt can give Brian a boner. So Justin enlists Michael for help.
I read that myself.
Quality work, Patrick.
Brian yells and screams at his mother, and lo and behold, his boner is back. Meanwhile, Sam's boner never went away, and it finds itself inside Lindsay in a bewildering art gallery hookup moment.
So much to talk about with that. Professor Ben Bruckner continues to fraternize with a student, well, ex-student, only to find out that what Anthony has wanted all along is for Ben to pass on HIV to him.
That was an interesting story.
Yeah.
By the way, Professor Ben Bruckner is 35 now. I looked this up. Last episode, we were talking about how old is this guy? I think you had thought in 40s, right?
I thought he was like early 40s, yes.
In season 2, episode 7, called The Leper, Hath the Babe Not Eyes? He gives his age to Michael after meeting Debbie for the first time in Michael's comic shop. He says he's 33 and a Pisces.
Yeah, I also wanted to see how you were, doing after last night. You know, after my big announcement. Hey there, my name is Ben, I'm 33, Pisces, love the outdoors, and I'm HIV positive. Yeah, it's still haven't figured out a way to drop that bomb gracefully.
Oh, so it's only been a couple of years?
Yeah. There's another amusing Ben moment. Every time I was typing up my notes, macOS kept autocorrecting Bruckner to the word brickbat.
Brickbat.
I don't even know what a brickbat is. I thought that was
it's
funny.
It's the same as fucking and ducking. Why?
You're right. What does ducking mean in that context?
We know what we're writing when we say ducking. Maybe if I start writing ducking, it will start to autocorrect to fucking. I don't know. Maybe. Let's try it.
Speaking of fucking, this episode had two cases of forbidden fruit, Ben and Anthony, and Lindsay and Sam. And so I think that's where the title A Snake in Paradise came from.
Yes.
So our A story tonight, Brian's boner. So the show opens up with Brian and Justin really getting to work.
No more Uncle Vic getting in his way.
What starts out as Justin getting into writing position turns into Brian flipping him over face down. That got me wondering, have these two fucked missionary since episode 1 of season 1?
When he took Justin's virginity?
Yeah. I don't remember another missionary position with these two. I couldn't think of one anyway.
No, I think they try and come up with a variety of ways. Now, what's interesting about Justin wanting to ride him is that he's obviously trying to guide Brian in. And it's not until Brian has a flash of the surgery and flips Justin over does he then grab a condom.
Oh, good point. Maybe Justin was just warming him up.
Just going to like tease a little bit before?
Just the tip.
Maybe.
Did you see the size of that ball that the surgery cut scene?
It was huge.
It was like kumquat size.
Now, Was that just for effect, or do you think that was actually them trying to comment on how big Brian's ball was?
Well, maybe it brings like some of the plumbing along with the diseased ball, but it looked pretty big. It was almost like a chicken leg or something that the prop people just grabbed from KFC and dropped into the pan. Said, "Here's Brian's ball."
I had Popeyes yesterday and not tonight.
There was something interesting about this scene that we get two frames of Brian's dick.
Yes.
Did you see it?
Oh, yes. Clocked it right away. Well, first of all, we were noticing that we were seeing a lot of like the pubic region, both on Justin and Brian. But yeah, when he goes to flip Justin over, yep, there it is.
Yeah.
You see it.
Big limp dick. Gail Harold, you go. So normally actors wear a kind of cup over their junk, but in this case,
or a cock sock.
There it is. It seems like Gail Harold kind of dispensed with that. And I seem to recall a Queer as Folk behind the scenes clip where Randy Harrison had said that they started out with those, but eventually just kind of gave up on them because they didn't really work and they were both comfortable shooting without them. And I couldn't help but thinking like, boy, you can't shoot that way today. Like with the intimacy coach on set.
You certainly could, but everything is choreographed now in a way where if it needs to be hidden, it can be.
That's what the intimacy coach does.
Yes, there's a way. Like, I actually saw a live theater show that had a lot of simulated sex in it, like a lot. And it was also in a very intimate space. So they had I think they were actually credited as a sex choreographer at that point in order for them to create these really graphic moments, but do it without it feeling like we've slipped into watching live porn, you know?
So you've directed actors nude on stage before. How did you go about staging that? Like, how do you position them and work them into, what's the blocking like?
So, well, that was actually a lot of conversations with my choreographer in a way of, one, making the actors feel comfortable, and two, making it clear that the motion that is being taken reads to an audience. So, at least in my particular show, we're supposed to assume that these, you know, they were teenage characters, are having sex for the first time. And the thing is, they were also singing their faces off while taking each other's clothes off. So, like, there was a lot of coordination that had to happen.
Now, your actors weren't teenagers, though, right?
No, they were in their 20s. But that's what was so impressive, is that my choreographer managed to choreograph it in a way that said, okay, so when he touches you here, you are going to move here. When she removes this, you are going to move here. And so they knew exactly where they were going to move to, where it felt like it was a natural thing, but they were also comfortable and knew what motion was coming next. So nothing was ever catching them off guard and something wasn't going to happen that they weren't expecting. And probably my favorite thing that my choreographer managed to pull off was that literally on the climax of the song, she managed to make it look like, oh, he has now penetrated her.
Oh.
in that exact moment. And it was so impressive that my choreographer pulled that off, because it is like, it's a profoundly sensual moment, but also we know that they were doing it in a way that all was in service to the story and never felt gratuitous. You have, I think, mentioned my review of the show where the big reviewer in Chicago has said that I never exploited my characters, which I was very proud of.
Were those two male characters, or was it a male-female character?
In this particular instance, it was a male and female character.
Really?
Yes.
I always thought it was two gay guys.
The two,
it's my dirty mind.
There are two male characters in the show that have an intimate scene later on. Okay. But it does not go it never went as far as that scene did.
I should have gone to your show. I'm sorry.
You should have, because it was great.
Got great reviews too.
Yes. I was very proud of that show. I still am. It's probably my favorite thing I've ever directed.
So Brian is hard at work at Kinetic.
Tell Jacob that if the art for Danny Loop isn't on my desk by 9 a.m. Friday, he'll be teaching remedial finger painting to kindergartners.
I noticed that Brian manages people with threats. That's Brian's story for his entire Kinetic role. And even his original job at, what was the name of his last agency? Gardner Vance, Vance Interactive or whatever it was. And
yes.
He's always threatening people instead of being like a good coach. or a good mentor.
No, it's very much like, get this done or you're fired kind of or experience.
You're going to be doing remedial finger painting. He's a terrible boss.
Absolutely.
I don't get that. I noticed that Brian compliments Ted on the suit he was wearing, his Dandy Lube suit. Have you noticed that for Brian, it's always like casual Friday now?
There's no tie. There's no suit. Yeah. He's got his sleeves rolled up because he's so overworked. Meanwhile, I love that Ted has this newfound self-confidence, and I'm glad that Brian recognized that.
Brian used to wear these nicely tailored suits. Now his dress shirt's always untucked. It's like one button open, just a bit too far. It's like, you should put that one button back up. He's rearranging the apple basket that's on the table. I don't like this version of Brian. I like the former ad exec Brian, even though, you know, he was a terrible ad exec and a terrible boss, but he just looked the part better. I don't know what the costuming strategy is here for him to just look less professional.
I felt like it was a way to show that he is overworked and he is swamped so much that he can't even put pride in the appearance of his business. But Ted's here to do that for him. So the storytelling is getting muddled again.
And another piece of muddling is when Justin tells Michael about his sex life with Brian.
JT hasn't gotten a rise out of Rage since Ice Tina zapped him with her radiation gun.
You mean, not since the operation?
I thought the doctor said that
nothing would be affected.
Well, something sure as hell isn't working.
Maybe you just need some Viagra.
You try telling him that.
Okay, so how about we take a little trip to Chinatown?
I already ate.
I meant to see Master Ni.
Who's he?
He's this herbalist Ben sees. He says he's a miracle worker. He gave him the stuff that actually helped lower his viral load.
Isn't Michael the last person that Justin would be talking to about his sex life? And wasn't Justin also at Michael's throat just last episode?
They are best friends, and then they are enemies, and then they are best friends again, and then they are enemies again. I think they get mad at each other when it suits them and when it's convenient to try and get what they need.
It's starting to annoy me.
Only now it's starting to annoy you?
Well, no. I think it started to annoy me 3 years ago when we started the podcast, but here we are. I did like that Michael says, maybe Brian needs some Viagra. Which is, he said it in all seriousness, but you would have thought that Michael, of all people, would know that that is not going to fly with Brian Kinney.
No, there should be no chemicals needed to help that along. Other kinds of drugs can definitely come into play, but not when it comes to Brian's performance.
Excuse me. We're looking for something to improve performance.
You a singer? Dancer? Comedian.
No, not that kind of performance. Sexual performance.
Huh? Sexual performance? Sexual.
Master Ni, the herbalist that apparently lowered Ben's viral load with all sorts of herbs and spices, to say nothing of the antiretrovirals that Ben was already taking.
But no, it was the herbs that did it.
Right.
I thought that whole scene was so cringy. I just...
Where did they find that set? It was like this candy shop full of
Know. But it was... I was uncomfortable watching that whole scene.
Well, this was another comedy scene that makes me wonder why it was there. Because if your boyfriend can't get it up, is the first thing that's going to come to mind is to go to Chinatown and have somebody whip up some kind of a tea?
I mean, no. That was just... The thing that I couldn't shake was, even though they actually had Asian actors playing those parts, it still felt very Breakfast at Tiffany's to me with Mickey Rooney, you know? From the way the music was used to introduce the fact that they're in, like, the China part of Pittsburgh. It's like... Was that all really necessary? I don't know. Everything seems super played up, as if they were going to some sort of a mythical shop. And yeah, it was a very uncomfortable thing to watch.
Well, after Justin fed the tea to Brian, it seemed like Justin expected him to just like step on a rake and get hard seconds later. It's like, here, drink the tea. Are you hard yet? It's like,
he thought it was some sort of instant potion. It's like, right. No, it's got to work.
What's that stuff that they give porn stars? They give them a shot of something like right in their dick. It's like Trimix, I think it's called. And it will immediately get to attention. Charge them right up.
This is why you should never try to emulate things that happen in porn. Everything is more controlled than you think.
Yeah, I like the final product, though.
Well, yeah.
So there's a steam room scene with Limp Dick Brian, and we haven't had a steam room scene in quite a while, and I'm pretty sure that that was the same set that they've used in the past. I wonder where that is. I wonder if that's a real Toronto bathhouse that they were
in. Bathhouses are never that well lit, so I highly doubt it.
Well, lit for TV.
Sure, yes.
There's a close-up shot of that hot guy feeling up Brian, and there's a gigantic pair of low hangers in the background right over the guy's shoulder. It looked like those nuts that hang from trucks.
From the back of it, from the trailer pickup thing.
Yeah.
The hitch.
And so there's a lot of like male genitalia here. I mean, you didn't have to look too hard for it. No complaints.
You would think in a show that focuses so much on gay men, yeah, this show does not go all out when it comes to male nudity. When it does, it's great that it's there, but other times they really skimp on it.
Yeah. So Debbie is walking the streets of Pittsburgh at 2 a.m., I guess. And here comes Brian.
She was finishing a shift.
Yeah, that didn't look like 2 a.m. to me. That But I had forgotten that Debbie and Brian were fighting, because the last interaction that we had was at Vic's wake, when Debbie slapped the shit out of Brian over that comment he made about Vic.
Yes, I had the same note. I had actually forgotten that Debbie and Brian have not spoken since Vic's death. And so I was happy that this actually came back and started to lead that road to reconciliation between them.
So the first thing Brian does is tell Debbie that he has cancer.
I see your point.
Yeah, so why didn't you see it then?
Maybe because I didn't know that I had cancer then.
Shit. Are you okay?
All right. They think. But who the hell knows?
The interesting thing in the writing here is that Brian didn't even bother to tell Debbie what kind of cancer he had, because the cancer spectrum is really wide in terms of mortality. And Brian happens to have one of the most survivable cancers.
And one that was likely caught early.
That was missing from the scene. Debbie could have thought, oh my God, he has like leukemia, you know, something that could knock him down in, you know, like a matter of months. But no, didn't need to be brought up.
But Debbie's also the kind of character that she doesn't need much to go into mother mode.
That's true.
So yeah. Just saying cancer, she's like saying you should be home resting. You should be doing this, that, and the other.
When you mentioned mother, it reminded me that I thought it was weird that Debbie tells Brian to talk to his own mother. Surely she knows how Brian feels about his mother and remembers that moment when Brian's nephew tried to frame Brian.
Oh my, I think that's Debbie trying to find the good in it in everything, because this is, you know, she doesn't want to have the same kind of regret that she had with Vic that Brian has with his mother.
Okay. I can get there with that.
Maybe.
Yeah. It's a very deep intellectual motif in the storyline there. Debbie did say something that I thought was really prescient, which is that the only reason Brian would stay up in the past was because it was up. I miss those old episodes where they were out all night looking to get laid. They were coming out of Babylon. It was, who am I going home with? This show just has a really different attitude and interest to it now.
It gets very domesticated, I think is the best way to describe it. It gets to a way to make gay life or queer life much more palatable to a wider audience, which is why we start to lose, I think, some of those more explicit scenes of hookup culture and like going to the bathhouse and all this anonymous sex that happened earlier on in the series.
All the things we hold dear.
Yes.
Debbie lecturing God was great. We finally got a moment of closure for Debbie and Vic after the last episode just wrecked her graveside farewell speech. I thought that this was about time that Debbie is having a conversation with God about Vic and saying her farewells to Vic.
Anytime you can just let Sharon Gless do her thing, I'm all for it. I mean, she's obviously one of the more seasoned actors in the show, and we can always trust her to be handed whatever the script asks of her, and she can deliver it. And I really like that scene.
Here's a weak story. Please bring it to life, Sharon.
Sharon, do something with this. Fix we have an up. Outline.
And then, oh, look, it's Joni Kinney just wandering into the church.
They still happen to go into the same Catholic church. That's great.
I thought it was a bit bad form for Debbie to tell Mama Kinney that she should really get in contact with Brian. That seems like something that she took liberties with, right?
She's approaching it, though, as a mother. I think deep down she's hoping that this could be the thing that unites a mother and son, even if they've had horrible blood in the past, that maybe this is the thing that can heal them. Because the last thing that Debbie would want would be for something to happen to Michael. And so she doesn't want that for Joni. I think, again, this is us having Debbie try to see the good in everybody.
Sure. But I think there's some things that you're supposed to reserve etiquette-wise for the person that's impacted by it. Like a miscarriage, for example.
Debbie and etiquette. I love that.
Fair enough. So then mysteriously, after Debbie says, hey, you should get in touch with Brian, she shows up at the office.
I thought it was very strange that Brian allowed Joan into the office.
Yeah, after throwing Justin out and getting restraining orders and everything. Come on in, Joni.
Yes, my homophobic mother. Come on in. I would have loved to have seen what that conversation was to say, like, yes, come in. Or yes, please see me at the office or something. Like,
how did she even find the office? How did she know where this is?
That's the stuff that I would have found interesting. But we didn't get that.
I guess we just have to assume that they phoned. That she phoned Brian and said, hey, Debbie said I should talk to you.
What's going on?
Yeah, let me show up at your workplace.
I would have loved to have had that drama because he would have seen that it was his mother and he would have hung up or something to where she manages to, because I think she's also a snake. She manages to sneak her way into the office and then we have a huge blowout.
Well, isn't it about time that Brian just gets over this with his mother? I mean, hasn't he resolved this internally yet, like especially after his father's funeral when he and Michael were bowling in the middle of the street with Jack Kenny's bowling ball?
Well, I guess that resolved things with his father, but I guess not with his mother. I had assumed that the last time we saw Joni was the last time we saw Joni.
This is the last time we see Joni.
prior to this moment, yes, I thought the last time, like when he was being accused of molesting his nephew, that I thought that was going to be it.
Did you notice that when he was yelling and screaming across his office at his mother that almost none of his employees seemed to notice? Like all the extras, the workers?
Just an average day at Kinetic.
Right.
Him screaming at someone, storming out of his office.
It wasn't until after it ended, one or two of them kind of looked up, but for the most part, they just kept working while it was happening.
I think it's that culture of fear that we talked about earlier.
Kinetic seems like a terrible place to work.
I'm sure the glass door reviews are just horrendous.
You have no idea how much I want to be hard. Oh, Lord, make me hard so that I can fuck every hot guy I see. That's why God gave me a second chance, Mom. So that I can use the one ball I have left.
Shame! Shame on you!
And if I have to spend an eternity of eternities burning in hell, it's better than spending one good day in heaven with you! Thank you.
So after yelling at his mother, I guess Brian can get a boner now. What?
Letting his mother have it got him hard.
I didn't get that.
Which is so strange.
So,
but I like the fact that he then looks up and says, thank you.
But then he walks all the way to Babylon with his boner to find Justin's mouth. And like all of Babylon celebrates his boner.
And his return. The fact that the song that you hear Sanctuary.
What's up? Funny you should ask. Oh! Is that a thing of beauty? And a joy forever.
As he comes into Babylon and right into Justin's arms with his boner.
If he had had a boner for that long, that's like call your doctor time, right?
That's medical attention. Yes.
Yeah.
That's what Viagra tells you.
That's what happened with Ted. Still Queer as Folk. We'll be right back. Stick around. So our B story tonight is Ben being tempted. So his story seems to revolve around Hunter and Michael shopping for diesel jeans.
Oh, the fashion of the early aughts.
I'm okay with that because I've really only worn diesel denim for years. So not like the crazy stuff.
So this is your brand.
Yeah. No, I don't wear the crazy ones. Just
no holes.
Some of them do. But I've kind of gotten more into like diesel jog jeans, which are, they're kind of like sweatpants that look like jeans. They just have a stretchy component to them. So they're like super comfortable. They're like lay on the sofa jeans instead of like skinny jeans where you just stay standing.
You can't move in them whatsoever. Oh, God, I hate that. Having the calves that I have, I can't ever wear skinny jeans. So.
Oh, you want carrot jeans then?
Carrot jeans?
Yeah, that's the diesel's cut. They call them carrots. So anyway, two characters in this episode called underwear shorts. And that seems like such an old man term. It's like Ben says it to Hunter and Drew says it to Emmett. And then Emmett says it to Drew.
I want to get a couple pairs of diesel jeans.
Pull up your pants. I can see your shorts.
I'm not posing in my shorts.
So I leap out onto your shorts, pull them down, and you have this humongous boner.
I don't know of anyone, any gay man, that calls their underwear shorts.
No, I just call it underwear.
Exactly. Or briefs. Or trunks.
Yeah, we usually call it like the cut of underwear that we're looking for.
When I hear shorts, I think like old man boxers.
Yes, boxers, yeah. That was my middle school. That was my middle school era where I thought I wanted to wear boxers. Yeah,
were you a skater?
No, I just thought like that was what I was supposed to have at that point. Ugh, next.
Anthony invites Ben to a lecture. He wants to go, but passes on Anthony.
Just to back up for a second. So Anthony is calling every hour, according to Michael, which is, I feel bad that we kind of missed the drama of Michael finding out about Anthony. I don't feel like we really got, because I feel like he would have been primed to be like, who is this person who's calling you all the time? And why are you going out and hanging out with him? But he seems like he already knows that Anthony exists. And we're just supposed to assume that he's been cool with it so far.
Michael reacted the exact same way he did when Ben was always working out with, I think his name was Hank or something.
Oh, the one who gave him the steroids?
Yeah. I can't think of that guy's name. Hank was Dr. David's son.
Oh, yes.
And so Michael was acting the same way. It's like, how dare you have like people outside of me that you talk to regularly? How dare you? Anthony saved him a seat at the lecture, even after he said he wasn't going to go. And that reminded me of that time that Brian put Justin and Ethan on the list for the carnival when Ethan says, well, we can't make it. And Brian says, your names will be on the list anyway. That's exactly what Anthony did here.
Yes, what a power move.
So then Ben bails on going to the mall with Michael and Hunter. Something I noticed in that scene in their apartment is that there's an iMac sitting on the desk in the background. Did Ben really need that MacBook that Michael bought for him? They've got a computer in the house.
I didn't even notice it. Now they're just swimming in computers.
That's right. Apparently the computer is not enough to keep Ben in the house or anything like that. And so Ben goes to Anthony's apartment. That kind of escalated quickly. And what was Ben doing at a student's apartment in the first place, though?
Well, first of all, let's clarify. He is an ex-student, or but he's a former student.
But he's a student at the university that Ben works at, regardless of whether he's in Ben's class.
Oh, he is still actually an active student.
I think so. He works in the library, and he had been last term.
Okay. Yes. Then I feel like the arts and letters world tends to get a little skewed when it comes to the professor student discussion. Because, like, at least in my school, you know, we were always hanging out with the professors because they were directing us in shows, or we were always doing so much work with them.
And did you try to take their shirts off?
No, there was no teacher I'd ever want to take their shirt off.
Did they invite you to their apartment?
No, I've been invited to houses, but, like, that was always with other students. It was never one-on-one. That's the difference. It was never one-on-one.
The post-lecture conversation is more like that happens with wine at a bar, not like a student saying, come to my place.
For a nightcap.
All I want is this. From the moment I saw you, I've fantasized about you. Admired you. Wanted to be like you. That's why I want you to give me the gift.
What?
I want you to be the one.
Anthony.
Make me positive. Like you.
Wait, stop it.
I thought Ben was going to plow him until Anthony announced his not so little ulterior motive.
I thought the same thing. I thought Ben was going to give in to temptation. And then we find out that Anthony has been fantasizing about Ben so he could be given the gift. And I will pass the ball on to you, Patrick, to discuss this, because this was...
Well, I think that would have been a much better story if they had hooked up.
Oh.
Then this other thing came into play. Like, if they had that moment of intimacy and started to generate feelings for one another beyond this kind of weird dance that they're doing, I think the drama would have been much better, and they definitely could have pulled that story out for a couple more episodes. But bug chasing is real, and it's considered a form of self-harm, like cutting. Since this episode aired and HIV is so much more manageable, I don't think this story aged very well, though.
I don't think so either. I mean, I think this is still... It's still definitely... I don't know if fetish is the right word, but there are definitely those who still... There still are bug chasers out there. But now that we have medication like Truvada and Descovy that offer a different layer of protection, it's now a very different world that we live in with regard to HIV.
The next day, Ben runs into Anthony at the library. It's like, oh, I've got to bring these books back.
Well, thanks for trying to talk me out of it, but it's too late. See, I went to a party last night.
What kind of party?
It's called a conversion party. I had unprotected sex with a dozen or so guys. It's not the way I would have preferred it, but hopefully it worked.
Oh, Anthony, for God's sake.
I said I should know in a couple of weeks.
A dozen or so guys fucked him. It's like, dang.
Now, do you believe him?
Oh, I never thought of that. I did. I thought for sure it was true.
There was just something in the way that he gave up the detail about, yeah, I had sex with a dozen or so guys, not exactly how I would have wanted it, but, you know, hopefully it took. And I'm like, you are also a writer. So, like, how do I know to truly believe that this is what happened?
That's interesting. I just assumed it did. I took the story that they were giving me.
Something to think about as we rewatch it, to think of how much can we really take Anthony's word as truth?
To say nothing of if 12 guys like unloaded on him last night and then he goes to work the next day at a stand-up job, it's like, you go.
I mean, good for you in that sense. I just, yeah, this
so such a weird story.
This reminds me of the, I believe it was in season two with Bellwether that see the BB is party. He was going to the BB party. So maybe Anthony was there. Who knows?
So Ben writes a short story about his Anthony adventure, but didn't he give up writing at the last episode and say he was going to focus on his teaching?
He's given up writing every three episodes. because something gets him down, so he's never going to write again. But now apparently he's given the inspiration, which I really hope that he gives Anthony like some sort of credit for literally taking his story or his life and making it into a short story. That is brilliant.
Well, instead of just sitting down with Michael and having a conversation and talking it out, Ben gets all creative and writes the short story. Okay, I'm good with that. But it's not quite as brilliant of a story as Michael says, right?
Is it?
Michael called it brilliant, and he seemed to think that this story was like groundbreaking. And the whole time I'm thinking, this isn't such a groundbreaking story. I mean, it's not Catcher in the Rye or anything like that. So,
what I focused on at the end of this, you know, when Michael gives his critique and they are embracing, and Michael says that he talks about what his favorite thing was, about how the main character doesn't sleep with the bug chaser and comes back to his partner. And I feel like this speaks highly of Michael in this moment, I guess, that we are to assume that Michael knows that this is exactly what happened between Ben and Anthony, and that Ben did not give in and instead came back to Michael.
Oh, interesting.
Is everyone fully aware that that's what's going on?
Yeah. Is this just a good story that I've jump-started my writing career, or is, honey, did this just happen to you?
Yes. And then is this your way of apologizing that I let it go as far as it did, but know that I didn't do it? Something I just noticed in that final scene.
Michael says that he's shocked and even disgusted that anyone would want to be positive. He's come a long way since he himself wanted to be positive back when Ben was on steroids and he was engaging in needle play.
Maybe you're right. Maybe you should be with a pause guy. Maybe that pause guy should be me. All it would take is a quick jab in a vein and be over in a flash. I'd hardly feel a thing, and then I'd be just like you.
He's shocked and disgusted, yet he did the exact same behavior. He had told Ben that he thought it'd be easier to be positive. He agreed with Ben.
But Ben still ultimately stopped him. So is this growth?
I think it's a lack of continuity.
Groundbreaking for this show.
Another continuity piece that I bumped on was apparently Hunter bought the REO Speedwagon CD for Michael and Ben with that god-awful I Can't Fight This Feeling song on it. Oh. Well, first of all, Hunter would have no idea who REO Speedwagon is, right? Second, the big thing missing from that scene that you were just talking about where they're embraced and they're slow dancing and that song is playing, Hunter needed to like bust in and join them in that hug.
Aww.
Because Ben chose family after all. He chose to go back to his partner. He chose not to engage with the bug chaser. Forget about Hunter.
What if Hunter was just like watching from the doorframe and let them have their moment?
Yeah, Hunter needed to be a part of that scene is, I guess, my point. Whether he just came running out and joined the hug into a group hug, or whether he was just kind of like looking out the door with a knowing glance going, yep, I've got it. It's still Queer as Folk. There's more on the way. So here's a runner that is probably not our favorite part of this episode, and that's Lindsay and Sam. Mm. I noticed that we both wrote down into our show outline that Sam Auerbach's ego is as big as his mural.
Tell me, Mr. Auerbach, why did you choose Pittsburgh?
Well, unless you're a Pirates fan, there's not a goddamn reason to come here. Now there will be.
That's perfect.
I've heard your ego's as big as your mural.
I hope I haven't let you down. I mean, I hope this bagel-deprived Berg feels the same way when they see my work.
I think that's all we need. That's good. That was great. Thank you.
Anytime, honey.
Once again, I think what gets my goat about Sam is that we are being told to buy into that his chauvinism is somehow charming or to be admired. And I think that also really shows the show's age, because now I think if we were to see this kind of, you know, play now, Sam would be skewered everywhere.
Probably be arrested.
Yes, actually that.
Stop stalking her. And then Glenda's magic wand comes out.
Woo. Well, also, it's been a long minute since I think we've seen a sex scene between Lindsay and Melanie.
Did you see how pregnant Melanie was in that scene when she was on her knees on the bed? Somehow she had like a big droop underneath.
Well, yes, because now she, well, I noticed her being more pregnant in the scene following rather than during this particular scene with the magic wand. But I mean, at least for continuity, they're keeping that around. But wow, as soon as she introduced that, Lindsay was just.
Well, was she?
Soaked.
Because they made a big deal out of it, but the scene was like maybe 30 seconds long. And the next morning, the magic wand needed more batteries. And Melanie is saying, you are wild and crazy. But they only gave us like a few seconds of them.
Of it doing its magic.
Right. So, okay.
We are to assume that it got wild.
Soaked the sheets.
Flooded.
Something I didn't get is why Lindsay abruptly decided that she wasn't going to go to work that night for the Sam Auerbach opening. So she gets down and dirty with Melanie, and that's enough for her to say, I don't want to go.
It's the fact that she used some sort of phallus to get off, that somehow equals to Sam. The jump that the show is making to get to this conclusion, this is why it's always been a bottom of mine since it's been introduced. I don't understand why it's there. I don't understand how we got there. None of it makes sense to me.
The whole lesbian like storyline has fallen apart in season four. It's like, is she pregnant? Isn't she pregnant? Is she supposed to take it easy? Is she not supposed to take it easy? Is she soaking the sheets with Lindsay? I don't know. I don't know where the lesbians fit in to this show other than this very weird storyline. So Sam and Lindsay in the gallery, this seemed to escalate really quickly. Answer me this, Matt. Did Lindsay actually enjoy getting fucked by Sam up against the wall? Because she sure didn't seem to be enjoying it at all. She was kind of willing, but the audio was making this at all hot.
No, first of all, he is insinuating that this tension between them is purely sexual and that she's always wanted him to fuck her. And then he grabs her to make out with her and start getting her out of her clothes and throwing her up against, I described it as rapey. I don't think there was ever a moment where it felt like, oh no, this is exactly what Lindsay has been wanting. And this is what the scene has been building. This is what their storyline has been building to. And it was an incredibly uncomfortable scene to watch.
I don't know what the intention in this scene was, but in the next couple of episodes, it apparently turns into Lindsay having real feelings for Sam, but that wasn't at all reflected in that scene. She didn't try to like run away. She didn't like slap him up. She didn't punch him like she's done in the past. But there was something about the way this was staged that made it seem really, really disgusting.
Yes, it was the aggression that occurred. Plays it off that this was not meant to be like, this is rough play, but clearly a turn on for both. But this is Sam taking what he wants.
Right. This definitely wasn't like Ted dragging the Dandy Lube boy into the stall.
No, not at all.
So something a little more upbeat in this episode is Emmett and Drew Boyd. This is our final runner of the night. So we find out that Drew is a power top, apparently. And he scored a touchdown in Emmett's butt.
He is pounding Emmett to oblivion. Like he was just throwing him every which way to make that score. And I will admit, this is probably the most vivid memory I have of seeing the show for the first time. It quite literally was when Drew was fucking Emmett all over that motel room.
Was that your middle school porn?
No, I don't think it was until a high school probably that I came across Queer as Folk. Mm. And then seeing that, and I was like, whoa, what is this?
I want to do that.
That's what I'm into.
Drew sure does like using the word fag.
I'm not a fag. Fag is a sissy. A fag can't even throw a ball. Name one fag who's a hero. Name one fag who's got a call from the president saying, great game. Name one fag that's fucked every Dallas cheerleader. Ain't one fag every kid wants to grow up to be. So why would anyone think I was a fag?
Maybe because you had your dick up my ass?
Oh, my God. That first of all, to describe himself as he's not a fag, and then continuing to use it as if to drive that point home.
Right.
I mean, his self-hatred is so strong. And so it was really surprising to have Emmett kind of just sit there and take it in a way. Like, I was always waiting for Emmett to be like, hold on, let's get this clear. So all he could get out was that...
Because you had your dick up my ass?
Right. Well, that like maybe someone wanted to grow up, because Drew makes a point saying no one wants to grow up to be a fag. I mean, that's a whole lot to unpack, because now we're trying, there's been such a push and such a fight to make sure that LGBTQ history is taught and that we understand that there are quite a few people that we would love to emulate that are in the queer community. So I found that really fascinating that the only person that Emmett managed to say specifically was Harvey Fierstein. That was it.
Well, Drew as an underwear model seems like a great idea. And I'm enjoying this story of Emmett shaping Drew into a proper gay man and underwear model.
I mean, he's already wearing the right underwear.
He is, yeah.
Those are trunks. They're trunks.
Probably boxer briefs, really.
Boxer brief. Make his package look great. Make his ass look great. Huge fan all around.
Did you know that Matt Battaglia, who plays Drew Boyd, has won 2 Emmys?
Yes.
As a producer.
As a producer, I'm kind of sad that he doesn't necessarily act a whole lot anymore. But I love the fact that he's still showing strong. And I'm telling you, if he still looks like that.
Still has the face. His face is like super recognizable. He's married, though.
Eh.
You can't call him.
Listen, we all saw what happened with Drew later on in this series. So who knows?
That's right. Okay. Tops and bottoms for this episode. My first top was the Emmett and Drew story. This is shaking out as a romantic comedy meet cute moment. And I love romantic comedies. And so I like this fun playfulness part that's going on, even as Drew is saying, fag, 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 fag. Emmett's rolling with it and he's coaching him. It's just so cute. Like when they're doing their little underwear photo shoot.
The photo shoot, yes.
Yeah, I like this. I thought this was one of the big wins in this episode.
So I have two. I have two tops here. One is the one we just discussed, because we see the progression of their relationship growing to where at the end of this episode, we see Drew, who at the beginning said that he never kisses fags, actually kiss Emmett because he wanted to. And I was like, it's kind of sweet. And I really love seeing Drew's ass and everything about Drew. I'm a huge fan. My second top is really the handling of the tough subject material, like the conversion parties with Anthony, and that whole desire to be positive as some sort of relief from fear. I think that's a big part of why that kind of community is out there. And I actually think the show handled it rather deftly with like what Anthony was seeking and why Ben is saying, no, you don't quite understand what it means to do this. So I appreciated how the show handled that particular subculture.
So for our bottoms, I think we're probably going to have the same bottom here. The Lindsay and Sam seduction was...
You are correct.
it was staged poorly. It definitely wasn't one of those mutually passionate moments. It had that rapey feel to it. This just didn't do the storyline any favors at all. It didn't do the
None
series
whatsoever.
Any favors. Did we share a bottom?
Yep, that was it. Eiffel Tower that. Mm.
This has been episode 10 of season 4, The Snake in Paradise. Next time on Still Queer as Folk, we cover episode 11. Brian fundraises for the Gay and Lesbian Center. Emmett and Drew keep fucking. Sam won't leave Lindsay alone. Ben and Michael have suspicions about Hunter. It's called Gay or Straight? That's the question.
Fresh reviews and ratings on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to us are much appreciated. So please take a moment to help us out. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
Find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall with no E's if you'd like to connect with me directly.
And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me tonight. We hope you'll join us next week for a new episode. Still Queer as Folk was made with love in Chicago.